morning. It's the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590, The Fan, Blake Murphy, Ailish Forfar, JD Bunkus. Give them a follow at their names on social. Subscribe to this podcast, please, and thank you. Wherever you get your podcasts, The Fan Morning Show. The Toronto Blue Jays lose last night. They drop it 2-1 to fall all the way down into a tie atop the AL East at 6-5. It's baseball. It's early. But JD has some anxieties. To help us sort through those, Stephen Brunt, co-host of The Fan Drive Time. Good morning. How are you, Stephen?
JD has anxieties. I have no idea what that's going to be like. That's shocking, Blake. I have no idea.
Your first appearance on the show with us, obviously. So, yeah.
Yes.
To paraphrase what JD was saying off the top of the show after that 2-1 loss last night, we did start the season with a lot of excitement, and there have been a couple injuries, sure, and it is baseball, but it doesn't feel like the Blue Jays have been quite the powerhouse we expected. They're 6-5, but they have a negative run differential, and they haven't, other than that opener when they came back, they haven't been quite as forceful. Are you seeing or feeling any of that at all, Stephen?
No. Is that okay? We're 11 games in. They've got 151 games to play.
Bring us back down to earth. That's good.
Look around. The American League East, potentially the toughest division in baseball. Maybe it won't be this year, but everybody's kind of the same. The Jays, I think the goal looking at this month and looking at the schedule would be to get out of April with your a little bit above 500, ideally, but just with your head above water, and then let things settle in. In the distant past of 2015, the Jays were 50-51. The Washington Nationals won a World Series when they were worse than that, middle of the season. There's a long way to go. So that's what I would say.
Okay. Paraphrasing.
You all right now?
This is just outrageous, first of all. Like, I love when this happens. It's like JD's anxieties, JD's this, JD's that. It's like, no. I do a radio show, so I bring up takes. They're not anxieties. They're just what I feel is, you know what? They've been kind of boring so far.
They're not anxieties. They're just feelings I have that make me anxious.
They're boring, so I'm not anxious about them. In fact, I've talked about this like over and over and over again that I stress enough how little I care about some of these guys' results early in the season. The one thing that I don't like so far, Brunt, is that it feels there are way too many times where they don't advance runners or they don't have good plate appearances. And yeah, they're going to normalize in that regard, but so far, like, the Bo Bichette approach can't be the approach for everybody on this team. And when you lose your DH, who's a great player, I just don't really love it when the offense feels as punchless as they do. And I wonder if at some point this season there's going to have to be just like a little bit more of a maturization or some type of a difference when it comes to what we saw last year at times when they would go through stretches where they didn't put enough pressure on teams, where they weren't doing kind of the simple stuff to win ball games, and it really cost them.
I think you've seen enough of Bo Bichette to know that he will self-correct because he's done this before, and it's he's very early in his career, but we have seen him self-correct. I think you saw Vladdy self-correct a little bit last night, even shooting the ball up the middle. They're going to score runs. It's going to be a very good offensive team. It's a little off kilter now because of the injuries. Just the lineup is not quite where it would be, and a guy like Alejandro Kirk, I think, is struggling because of the extra catching duty he's had to take on. I think that hasn't helped him get off to a good offensive start. But they're going to score runs. Some of these guys are streaky. Gurriel is, notoriously streaky. Vladdy may have been, after the three-homer night, may have been trying to hit everything 100 miles for a couple of days. It's kind of human nature, I think, maybe. I just think you've got to kind of let them play baseball. You're going to have nights like last night, which was, Eovaldi wasn't great last night, but, there was good pitching on both sides last night. Pitching's going to win sometimes. And I don't think they're going to clobber everybody 6-1 this year. I think this is going to be a really I think this is a very well-constructed team. I think the bullpen has been sensational. I think the rotation's a little bit of a work in progress, but you got to be really happy with Manoah and what he's done. You got to be really happy with what Gausman's done. Kikuchi last night, you kind of see the work they're doing with Kikuchi and what they see there. We'll see what Barrios looks like today, but you know, guy who's been very consistent. The Ryu thing is that's a huge question mark, but he's one of six guys right now, so it's not as vital as it might have been. And I think if you look at who those players are in that lineup right now, they're gonna hit. They're gonna be nights when they don't, and they're gonna be nights when it's frustrating. But that Red Sox lineup is pretty good last night. It was pretty good as well, and they scored two last night. So it happens.
I'll tell you one thing from your answer there, Steven. I want to come back to the Ryu stuff for sure at some point. But if I hit three home runs one night, yes, you would never get me to not swing for home runs ever again. Ever, ever, ever again. I mean, I could do that. I possess the power. I've hit the odd home run in my life of playing baseball, and I feel like it takes like 2 weeks of correction to just stop swinging for the fences after that. Now, I want to present JD's point a little bit more fairly because I was, okay, you know, doing this
why
at
would
a
you
high
do
level.
That? Why would you do that, Blake? This is it's fairness. Is there a fairness principle in talk radio? I didn't know.
So
you don't have to be fair.
What we got into earlier is, yes, and Bo is emblematic of this because he's bottom 10 among all qualified players in pitches seen per plate appearance. He's barely getting three pitches per plate appearance. And the Jays as a team are third last in that stat. And I wonder if while Teoscar's out, while you're playing a couple guys who are sputtering a little bit and aren't giving quite the same punch that you'd expect, and yes, you're playing some guys at the bottom of the lineup that maybe you weren't expecting to play every day, do you think that long term there's a need to tweak the philosophy of this team just a little bit? And again, it's early, 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 but they were also like this last year. They were one of the lowest walk teams last year, and they were guilty at times of not making starting pitchers work a lot. You said Eovaldi wasn't that sharp last night. He wasn't, but he also didn't look all that stressed. He was pretty comfortable over those first four innings. So would you like to see this team be a little bit more selective and a little bit more, hey, work a deep count. Let Springer and Vlad see a few extra pitches. Let's get into the bullpen a little earlier. Is there anything to that for you?
Well, I'm not sure there's such a thing as a team hitting philosophy. Let's start with that. Mm-hmm. Like, I think you've got a bunch of individuals who all kind of, have their own strengths and weaknesses. And just about everybody we're talking about, you know, including the young guys, are established who have had success as major league hitters. So I don't think you gather around in a circle and say, let's take more pitches. I don't think that's how it works. And a guy like Bo has succeeded doing what he does. He's very aggressive. His mechanics are the reason there was a big discussion about his mechanics before he was ever drafted, and about the way the way he sells out. But that's him. There's no lack of work. He's one of the harder working guys on the team, and I assume he's working with the hitting coaches, and they're looking at reams and reams of video and looking at those at bats. But I think he's just scuffling. Honest to God, and it happens, especially happens early in seasons. And if this happened in the middle of July and he was having a really good year, you wouldn't notice it. I think they'll go back to being who they are. And I think we know who they are. They're probably not going to take a ton of walks. There's not really anybody on this team who takes a ton of walks. And, including Matt Chapman, who he will walk, but he'll strike out a ton as well. But they don't really have that classic on base guy, but they can score a ton of runs still. There's different ways of doing it. So I'm sure Bo Bichette is aware of every pitch that he has seen this year. I'm sure he's watched every pitch he has seen this year. We know what he is. He's not 19 years old just making his major league debut.
Yeah, and I don't want Bo to change who he is. I just look at something like, hey, last year, he works his plate appearances where he's behind in the count 1.5 times as often as when he's ahead, and right now that's a 3-1. And while you're struggling, maybe it's a worthwhile shift. But I get what you're saying. These are the top of the order, at least, is known commodities. JD, I know you have something on the less known commodities on this team and a curiosity there.
Well, so, Brunt, I guess what I want to bring you on today to discuss is, like, you know, I agree that you can't really have big Bo Bichette takes the second week of the season, But do you put more stock into getting to see more from bench guys? Because, like, now they get to see Zach Collins a little bit more, right? They get to see him just about every single day. You get to see more of Tapia. You get to see more of the depth of this team. And so you end up with more plate appearances from these guys early on. And, yeah, again, it's still a big data extrapolation point sport. But do you feel like you get a better understanding of who these guys are now, or it's harder because the vision of the team was for them to be limited in these spots, and they're basically only supposed to be around to supplement those players that are supposed to be healthy?
Yeah, I think, well, when your lineup is healthy, they're going to go back to being supplemental players who are not going to be pinch hitting a lot with this team. So, you know, and a guy like Zach Collins, it's great right now. And, you know, he has hit a little bit. He's, you know, he is a bad first guy, so that's not totally shocking. Well, I thought he looked awful to start, you know, the first few plate appearances. I kind of wondered what anybody was talking about. Tapia is a mystery to me. I'm not sure I get him yet. But yeah, you're going to get to see a little bit of them, more of them now. I think you're going to see Zimmer a little bit as well. There's, you know, he's a guy that Cleveland spent a lot of time trying to unlock because of all his athletic potential, but he never hit. So you're going to see him, you know, but I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure down the road. I think down the road, you know, we're not going to be talking about Zach Collins. We're going to be talking about Gabriel Moreno, which is probably a better conversation.
Yes. Yes, it is a better conversation. Yeah. I guess it's just like Tapia you bring up.
Yeah.
And I go, yeah, that doesn't make sense to me either. And it just seems like they made a trade to make a trade. But then I'm going, okay, well, maybe if these guys are healthy and he's not supposed to play, he is just there as a guy who's meant to swipe bags and get the odd limited at bat given a situation. And now because he's playing too much, we go, this guy makes no sense. And that's what I guess I'm struggling with is, like, because we see him more, does he make less sense? Or when we see him less, will he make more sense and he actually does fit? Like, that's sort of the angle of this.
Well, he's your fifth outfielder when you're healthy. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure you're going to carry five outfielders when you're healthy. Like, there's going to be some interesting roster stuff to deal with here down the road. But he's your fifth guy. He hits from the left side. He doesn't look like a great offensive player by any means. He can run. He can pinch run. He's probably a better defensive player than Grichuk was. And that's why they made that deal. They took a little bit of financial pressure off, but not much. But they wanted a guy who hit from the left who they could potentially play in center field. And then they went out and got Zimmer, who they actually can play in center field and is the best center fielder on the team right now defensively. I don't know what his future is when, you know, even when they cut down to 26-man rosters here. How many – right now they're carrying three catchers and five outfielders. I'm not sure that roster construction makes sense. But, you know, he doesn't have to be – great. They carried Jared Dyson, you know, at the end of his career just because he could, in theory, go and catch stuff in center field and pinch run every once in a while. That's all he had to be. So, look, if any of these guys turns into more, like if this Zach Collins thing is real and, you know, he's a significant left-handed bat off the bench who can DH for you against a righty, yeah, that'd be great. I think that they would be thrilled because that's way more than what Rhys McGuire was. And he looks adequate behind the plate. You know, maybe that's enough, but I think there's way more chance that this is an illusion than what we've seen the last little while. But enjoy it, right? Like you can't get him out now. Left-handers can't get him out right now. So enjoy it while it lasts.
So you mentioned Moreno, tiniest of samples, of course, but he's hitting .389, .421, .500 at AAA. He's only struck out twice in 19 plate appearances. He's throwing out runners. What would he have to do to push the Jays ahead on, hey, it's not a Collins Heinemann thing? Or is that more of a, hey, if Kirk keeps sputtering, you need to look at an option? Like, who's in control of Moreno's timeline most right now?
Well, I think if he does that for another 2 months, it's going to be pretty hard to keep him down.
If he's hitting .400 at Buffalo 2 months from now, we're going to be having a different tone to this conversation. I'm going to be doing this from Buffalo, where I have a rental car waiting for Gabriel Moreno.
I think he's going to force their hand. I don't think they're going to be able to keep him down. And then there's going to be I don't know what the roster implications of that are, because there's a lot that, you know, it depends on who's healthy. But, you know, like, yeah, obviously, you've got a guy who's a AAA catcher on your roster right now. just as kind of an insurance policy. Obviously, he's gone. He's gone the 1st of May when they cut their rosters down. But I don't think they're going to be if Moreno is dominating at AAA offensively and he's playable defensively. You and he looks like a superstar, and you're trying to win. You know, he's going to force their hand. So, like, I think Aurelvis Martinez less so. That's the other guy, because he's in Double A and he's really young for that level. And right now, you know, he hasn't played any second base, so I'm not sure where he plays. But I think Moreno, even though, you know, in theory their catching situation is kind of taken care of, I think he's going to be in Toronto before, I don't know, like, pick a day. I guess we could look at the Super 2 deadline, right? If you're being cynical, yeah, you can look at the Super 2 deadline and say the day after that. But it looks like you're not going to be able to hold him down.
You mentioned forcing their hand. Well, has Ryu kind of done that in a sense? You know, he's had a little bit of a slow start. Looks like he's carrying into a little bit of last season into this year. He's on the 10-day IL now. But what happens if he comes back and he's not better? And how much of this do you think could be a mental block that he's facing? What happens, you know, to the roster and to the type of play that the Blue Jays need from him if he comes back and he's not good?
It is a hell of a question, Eilish, because I think if you, Ross Atkins, was on here and being fully forthright, I don't think he could answer it either. Mm-hmm. What do you do? You know, I don't think they have any. I don't think they know. You know, Ryu is a, you know, idiosyncratic pitcher. There's not a lot of other Ryus out there doing what he does, and, you know, to be effective, obviously it's a super fine line, and, you know, whether the difference is the 3 miles an hour in fastball velocity he seems to have lost. Maybe it is, but, you know, he's 35. I think the injury thing, the thing is, you can't, there's not a lot of alternatives here. They owe him $20 million this year and $20 million next year. Now, he's not your ace. He's not in the front of your rotation. So, you know, from a baseball point of view, it's not fatal because of the other guys you've got pitching in that rotation right now. But yeah, if he can't get people out, which right now and in the last half of last season appears to be the case, I don't know, you know, they'll bury him on the injured list for a while, and you can keep him there for quite a while and pretend that he's hurt. You know, maybe he's really hurt, I don't know. But he looks sort of like he looked at the end of last season. But if he just can't get guys out anymore, there are no good alternatives, right? You can't send him out there to get shelled the way he's getting shelled now. And I don't, you know, Pete, look, I think if you watch Kikuchi last night, you see the work that what Pete Walker's trying to do with him. You know, he threw a ton more fastballs last night. They're going to simplify his repertoire, say, you're going to throw 40% fastballs, and let's see how that works. Ryu, you can't do that. You can't change him. He's, you know, he's figured something out, and it's sort of like trying to, you know, figure out R.A. Dickey or something when he was here throwing knuckleballs. Like, what do you do if it doesn't work? There's nothing you can tell him. Mm-hmm. So, I do not know. And I guarantee you they do not know either.
Yeah. I want to be as loved as Pete Walker for having a strategy with, like, Robbie Ray turns him into Cy Young. He's like, do less. It's like, works. Now with Kikuchi today, is like, you do less. He's like, oh, wow, what a genius. Like, do less. Do less is a philosophy I really like. I think that maybe we should all apply this. And, Brunt, I think that you working with Ennis has you, yes, like, the downside of this is now you're more prepared for me to have takes on April 20th in a baseball season. You kind of came in, you're like, I'm ready for this today. Like, I'm sharp. I'm not having any of it. I'm going to tell them what day it is, the season. I don't like it, you know? I think that you're too prepared now for early baseball takes.
I'm just one coffee in. It's April. We have done this before, though. I used to do it when you were with Ennis. So that was,
yeah, I know.
That was
but
different.
But now
dynamic,
you're prepped. Yeah. You get like a preview, you know? You get a preview because I'm texting some of these things. You get it the night of. Thanks for making time, Brunt. Always great.
All right. See you guys.
See you, man. Stephen Brunt. Fan Drive Time again today with Ennis. And yes, very prepared for early season baseball takes. I think some of those do apply, though. Again, the Ryu thing is interesting. I actually liked, by the way, Kirk behind the plate because there's a lot of low strikes, and he's a low strike receiver. And I thought some of the framing that he did was impactful for Kikuchi. And I wouldn't be surprised if those two guys stick together throughout the season. Actually, now,
Him with Gossman for that same reason, because that splitter is going to work down in the zone a lot.
Yeah. So I thought that was nice, but I'm with you, and we kind of dance around a little bit. He's right. They're not always going to become a heavy walk team. Like, that's just clear. But that's also still why I feel like they're a bat away come deadline time. And that's why I feel like I'm going to be advocating for them to have some back come deadline time. I just want a little bit more insulation with the lineup to have that guy that does do that. Because this is a large sample size sport. So asking a Tiger to change his stripes probably isn't going to happen with a lot of these guys. But adding somebody later in the year, that's probably going to be that. And this is me doing my due diligence now, where it's laying the foundation for having the take at the deadline of, I've been saying this all season, but they need more versatility in the lineup. They need to add a bat that can draw more walks. And yeah, I like Brunt saying, I don't really get the Tapia thing. He called him the fifth outfielder. My understanding is he's still the fourth, like, unless we're bumping up Biggio. Or I think it kind of says something if you traded Randall Grichuk for your fifth outfielder, and now you've elevated Zimmer to your fourth outfielder. I don't really know what that makes you, but either way, Randall Grichuk played a lot of games for this team the last couple of years. And so removing that and now having Tapia and Zimmer, who are both completely hopeless at the plate. Like, do you guys hear Shulman talking about Tapia to lefties yesterday?
He looks really uncomfortable at the plate.
It's such does he stand so far away from the plate?
I don't understand that.
He's uncomfortable with being close to the plate.
It looks so strange.
It's awful. Oh. It's awful. And so, yeah, that's a bit of a bench oddity to me. I'm with him. Collins probably regresses a little bit. I won't say he will, because I have bought stock now. I love the guy.
You're getting his jersey, I thought.
If you're
JD Bunkus.
He didn't win me that bet. Well, that's how you get me to buy your jersey, is you win me money, and then I'll take some of the earnings. And let's just say no jersey buying of the Phoenix Suns. That's for sure. Phoenix Suns, you screwed me. But either way, Zach Collins probably regresses. He does change the Gabriel Moreno conversation. It doesn't make it as desperate given the way that he's playing right now, but at least you see the approach and you go, okay, well, like, the guy can clearly, he has power. That's undeniable with Zach Collins, is this guy has power. He can run into baseballs. With Tapia, I really don't know what his purpose is outside of, if he can get on first base, he can score maybe on a single, or he can steal bases. Like, he can't field his positions and he can't hit. And he stands in the weirdest way ever at the plate on the team.
All right. So it's time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats.
Yum, yum, yum.
We got a couple here. The first one is, maybe Raimel Tapia is afraid of the ball. The second one is, maybe Pete Walker's pitching coach strategy is just Paul Rudd from Forgetting Sarah Marshall when he's trying to teach Jason Siegel how to surf. Do less. Well, you got to do something. Do less. But the something to chew on here is, let's keep it on the catcher. So I mentioned Gabriel Moreno's stats. Obviously, we're not going to have very robust stats from him. He's played 6 AAA games in his career now. And I don't really know what kind of fidelity we're taking from minor league catching stats. What we can look at, though, is I think if Alejandro Kirk starts hitting, that makes things easier. While he's not hitting, the focus is understandably, and even if he was hitting, more on his defensive catching. So, JD, I pulled up some numbers while you were talking about how you're impressed with Kirk's ability to steal strikes low in the zone. On strikes over the plate, but low. So they're technically balls, but they're over the plate. 54.5% of those that weren't swung at, Kirk's stolen a strike on this year. That's one of the top rates in baseball. That was the case last year as well. He started improving on that. Apparently, they were really encouraged about that in spring training. So something that you want here is, yes, Kirk needs to start hitting at some point, but he's maybe turning into an okay enough defensive catcher that you don't need a Tyler Hanneman to be the extra catcher. Or, hey, if Kirk starts hitting, you're not as worried about the defensive side if you're trying to get him in the lineup 5 days a week. Let's take a break.
Can I just want to comment on Kirk before we do that quickly? And I know we have Kevin Calabro, and I don't want to keep him waiting. But I think Kirk's going to hit, because you see certain signs.
He's a hitter.
Yeah, and not only that, you see things even when he does hit the ball for outs. The exit velocity is – he's a good exit velo guy. And he's also someone that can work a walk, which is something that this team doesn't have in abundance, and something that I do like about him. The defense has been a challenge, but now if they can find a little bit of added value there, that's nice. My issue with Kirk right now that I guess I'm examining a little bit more closely in terms of how I feel about it is the negative of his base running and how that equates to what he does with the bat. Because he's got a hit, because he's not a plus glove. You're a hope he gets by glove. And those are nice stats that you pointed out, Blake. But the base running and the amount of times where it's like he hits into double plays and you know it's hopeless. If it's a ground ball in the infield and there's a runner on, you know that that's two. And you
buddy,
also.
This guy had two infield hits yesterday.
And you also know that when it's him in front of another runner, that it's really clogging up the base paths when that does happen. And you go, okay, this is going to take hits. This is going to take a lot to move this guy. Like, I don't exactly know what that looks like for him. So it's like, what is the minus of the base running for a player like this? The defense helps him a lot, though. The defense helps him a lot. Because, again, at some point, Gabriel Moreno is going to come up. And at some point, it looks like he's going to be a catcher. And at some point, that's going to make the Blue Jays, when Brunt says force their hand, make some decisions at that position. Sorry. Now let's take a break. And let's talk to a childhood hero of mine who, I don't know. There's very, very few times where you feel a little nervous talking to somebody about doing this job. And
him and Gunther.
Gunther, I felt no nerves. I felt no nerves whatsoever because I knew he was going to be an absolute stud. And I knew he was going to come in with the great answers, and that only emboldened my love for Haas. Although still no email from Haas a million years into the
Where's
new season.
The merch?
Still no merch from Haas. They can't take the Urcali logo off their gear. They just can't figure out how this works. How
Stitch
to print
rip it.
Like, there's websites that turn around T-shirts, you know, make a
One
billion
hour.
New T-shirts in an hour. And Haas.
There's a place in Toronto. 10-minute tees.
Yeah. Haas, someone talk to Haas about the value of merch, please. Someone, please, for the love of God. Actually, Daniele, reach out to those people again. Say, can we get some free stuff? Because this is really hurting our show. Let's take a break. Let's talk to the voice of the Sonics who's calling the Raptors game tonight, Kevin Calabro. It's the Fan Morning Show. JD Blake and Ailish, Sports at 590, The Fan.
Smart takes on the biggest stories in sports. The Fan Drive Time with Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunt. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fan Morning Show. JD Bunkus, Ailish Forfar, Blake Murphy, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. I don't know how you guys feel right now, and I'll change my opinion differently as the day goes on because there's different levels of, I guess, stress, but there's almost like a weird calmness to this Raptors season now for me because they're down in this hole, and now remember when I asked about the view about when would expectations change in a series for you with the Raptors, right? But our assumption, as all three of us picked the Raptors to win, was that it was going to work the opposite way where you'd feel a little bit more stressed that they wouldn't be the team that blew it. Tonight is a weird feeling for me in the sense of Philly's up 2-0, and the Raptors are totally the we-have-nothing-to-lose team now, truly. Like, everybody in the fan base went with, oh, there's no expectation. Sure didn't feel that way to me when everyone was crying about the officiating in the last two games that, you know, people didn't really care about the outcome of this series. However, I kind of do feel that way tonight. Heading into it, if you're looking at reasons that the Raptors might have a psychological advantage or have an advantage of any kind, it's that they're truly playing with nothing to lose. They're down 0-2 and they're missing Scotty Barnes.
Mm-hmm.
Blake is muted, going to roll through to our next guest. Ooh. Very good. Our next guest does play-by-play work for the NBA on TNT. He does it for the Portland Trailblazers, but he will always be, to me, the voice of the Seattle Supersonics. It's Kevin Calabro. Good morning.
Good morning. How are we doing?
We're saying that we are doing something strange, which is that the Raptors feel like they have nothing to lose. And in a series where we came into it thinking, hey, the Sixers have a lot of pressure on their shoulders, they're up 2-0. That's a great spot to be. But if you're the team that has the expectations and now that's built up even further and you're facing a group that does have nothing to lose, do you think there's a value in that for the Toronto Raptors tonight, Kevin?
No. To be honest with you, I don't. I think it comes down to talent. Joel Embiid is an MVP. James Harden is one of the greatest scorers we've ever had in the 75-year history of the league. And I think he's got a legacy that He has not expressed it, but I would think that somewhere deep within him, he's got to be thinking, it's time. I mean, he went to the finals his third year in the pros when he was with Oklahoma City coming off the bench, of course, with KD and Westbrook and Ibaka. And he's been to the conference finals a couple of times, lost to the Warriors twice in 15 and 18. But no chips. No chips for Harden. Tyrese Maxey's playing at an incredibly high level right now. He's got a speed element that I don't think Toronto can match either. And as you mentioned, you've got Scotty Barnes out. This is a team that's challenged. I mean, they're a determined group, no question, but they just don't have a matchup for Embiid. I mean, that's my simple analysis of what's going on. And, you know, you just look out there, it's all about talent. If you've got Harden and you've got Embiid, and they seem to be coming into their own now. Doc has used this week as a training camp. They've had just, 21 games together. And Embiid's numbers are astronomical, and Harden's numbers aren't that bad either when you consider, you know, the 21 games. He shoots 32% from three, which is down from his average. But, you know, he's in game one, he had 14 assists and 22 points and, you know, didn't shoot it particularly well and still hit four threes in 40 minutes. So I think for Toronto, it's you know, pray that they can take the boot off of Scotty somehow miraculously in time for game three. Hope that Thaddeus Young can contribute as well. And, you know, not having Gary Trent being Gary Trent Jr., I think really sets you back because you need that scorer out there. And, you know, for him not to play in the second half because of the illness, and obviously in game one he wasn't himself, you know, who knows, maybe in a 24-hour period of time Gary can turn back and get his health back because it certainly would help. But, no, I just think Philadelphia is pretty determined. You know, I think it'll be a heck of an effort tonight, as it has been, or it was certainly in game two. I thought that, you know, they got off to a terrific start to Toronto when Van Vliet came out and hit the threes and then got cold. Philly's also, I think, got a real nice second unit that they play in a small unit out there that features Reed at center and just kind of a placeholder out there. You know, they bring Shake Milton off. They won't have Seibel tonight, but Milton, I think, is capable of stepping in and providing that role. I don't think that's going to really diminish what Philadelphia does tonight.
Kevin, there are a few things quite as deflating as, oh, the other team is using this as an extended training camp to get ready for the real series. It's very much the...
Well, no. He used... I meant to say that he... I didn't mean it that way.
You meant the regular season.
A week in preparation for Toronto as sort of a mini training camp because obviously when you get it, when you've got a trade as they did, and then you're trying to coach on the fly. It's very difficult because, as coaches will tell you, they simply don't have days off in which to practice. So this has been a very very purposeful week for Philadelphia, and unfortunately Toronto's catching them at the wrong time with the injuries, and then Embiid just having a marvelous year this year. And I think Harden's going to hit his stride.
So a lot of the analysis coming into this series that was optimistic about the Raptors, and it wasn't just here. There was some national optimism that this could be a series. Raptors could pull off the upset. Some of that hinged on, well, if you punch Philly in the mouth, you don't know how they're going to respond because of Harden's playoff track record, because Doc Rivers doesn't have the best postseason track record over the last few years. Philadelphia's been allowed to get comfortable now in the series. So I would, based on the way you set tonight's game up, it feels like the Raptors would have to do more than just win tonight's game to make Philadelphia uncomfortable in this series. So what is that factor then that Toronto gets back into the series, not just in terms of it's 2-1, but that it feels like a series once again for you?
Well, I think they're going to have to shoot lights out, and that's where I think Gary Trent Jr. really, you're going to need him tonight. You're going to need as much scoring as you possibly can. I mean, they're a determined group. They're going to crowd Embiid. They're going to try to muddy this thing up as best as they can in the paint and so forth. But you can't have a guy like Danny Green find the corner and knock down a couple of threes as he did in the second quarter of game two. You can't have Tobias Harris get free in the corner as well. I mean, you're going to have to spread yourself a little bit out into those corners to get those three-point shooters, and that leaves one-on-one coverage for Embiid, and that's a very difficult assignment indeed. So you're going to have to be darn near perfect, I think, to win this game and to win the series, and you're going to have to be healthy. And I don't know where that leaves Scotty. I don't know what his status is for tonight, but you know, the guy's got a walking boot on the leg, so I don't know where that puts him.
Yeah, it puts him doubtful. Slight optimism for a return later in the series. But, again, it's not really feeling like it's going to be a later in the series, especially given this. Do you think that Tyrese Maxey is becoming a legitimate star in this league in front of our eyes?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that. He's just possesses incredible quickness that allows him to get to the bucket, either score at the rim or to find shooters in the corners, as I've mentioned. And oh, by the way, the guy can legitimately shoot three-pointers all day long. So pick your poison. It's just marvelous to see what he has done. I mean, last year he played in 61 games. He had 8 starts. And, of course, was playing behind Simmons. But you can see by moving Simmons out, this frees up Maxey. And I thought that was a brilliant deal to keep both Thybulle and Maxey and not allow them to get away in that deal to move Simmons, Seth Curry. That hurts. Obviously, not having that perimeter shooter, Drummond, you know, give you some size up front. But, boy, to be able to keep Maxey and Thybulle, those two on board. I mean, his speed is an absolute factor. He's shooting 43% from three. He drives to pass or to score. I think he is, he's a legitimate star. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, it's been in a way painful because obviously we're rooting for some Raptor success, and the team takes a lot of pride and the fan base takes a lot of pride in the defense of Fred VanVleet, a guy who's going to be an All-NBA defensive player this year. But boy, the way that Maxey has played, I think it's kind of fun for any basketball fan, and he's got a joy to his game that's fun to watch as well. So yeah, I think we all agree that the Sixers look better than a lot of us anticipated. The Raptors look worse. They're not healthy. They need a lot from Gary Trent Jr. Maxey's emerging and just looking phenomenal. Blake asked you how they get back into the series. It's with the shooting. Absolutely it is. But did we sleep on the Sixers maybe as contenders? Like, because you mentioned it. You think Harden's going to get going and that he's still chasing that elusive championship ring. Embiid was the MVP this year. Maxey should have already been a little bit established. They did change those pieces mid-season, but it feels like we were always searching for drama with Philly, and now we're watching all these playoff series, and you've done games. I think you did the Mavericks game last, if I'm not mistaken. Did we sleep on them a little bit in terms of their ceiling as a team or their contender status a little bit as a team? Because I don't feel like the consensus with the media was that they were in that tier.
Yeah, you know, I'll be honest with you, I didn't really buy into all that. Because I had not studied Philadelphia that closely, and being in the West, you know, I didn't really follow Philadelphia that closely. I just knew that Embiid was just an absolute monster to match up against. And when you've got a guy like that with such gravitational force, who can also spread the floor, by the way, he can shoot from the elbow, he can extend from three, he can handle the ball and get it down the floor. I mean, we're talking about not just a generational player, I mean an all-time top 75 pivot man. I mean, you can put him, I think when his career is done, knock on wood, sans injury, you can put him in the top five of the best five men to ever play the game. And now you've got guys out around him that are starting to pick it up. Maxey's, of course, we've touched on him and his abilities, and some of the shooters that surround this guy. And by the way, they're well coached. Doc Rivers is a hell of a coach. This might be the most talented. I'm going to ask him that tonight in our interview, if this is the most talented team he's ever had. Because you look at that 08 team that they had, obviously, with Pierce and KD and with Allen and with Rondo, who I think was a rookie or a second-year pro at the time in 08. I think he was a rookie at that time, and they beat the Lakers in 6 games. With Allen, Pierce, Garnett, and Rondo, I don't know. This might be better than some of those L.A. teams that he had as well with Chris Paul, with Blake Griffin, obviously, and with DeAndre Jordan and J.J. Redick. That's what you're talking about in this Philadelphia team. And I think Doc realizes that. He's won 100 games now in the playoffs. He's like the fourth or fifth most all-time in coaching victories in the playoffs. He's got over 1,000 coaching wins. So I think Philly is primed. I don't know what other guys were saying or gals were saying, you know, in prognosticating the season. I don't get into that stuff because I don't see the future like a lot of these guys do. But what I can tell you is what's happening right now, particularly with the Booker injury last night. Things suddenly they were wide open to begin with. They're even wider open now.
Yeah, did you have the Suns as the prohibitive favorites? Because like it did feel like there was quite a significant gap between them and the Western Conference and everybody else. Like you looked at especially their crunch time numbers, and you said it, you're a Western Conference guy. How do you evaluate that conference now? Like I know you said it's wide open, but do you have a favorite in the West?
Well, I just think because of the way they defend, first and foremost, I thought the Phoenix Suns, and I still do, you still have to knock off the king of the West in order to be the king. And with Luka's injury, I think that even opens things a little bit wider there in the West, the aperture. And we don't know how long Burka will be out. We know he's had a history of the hamstring, and it's soft tissue injuries are really touchy subject. They still have an awfully good basketball team. It means Mikal Bridges is going to have to pick up the scoring. He's already a lockdown defender, maybe the second or third best defender in the league. It means Ayton's going to have to score a little more. It means Cameron Johnson suddenly is going to be a huge factor in this series against the upstart New Orleans Pelicans. Brandon Ingram has suddenly awakened and I think is realizing that he can be a star at this level. I think he just needed an infusion of confidence, and I think the addition of C.J. McCollum has done that, and Larry Nance as well. He's got some mentorship now on that young team. I wouldn't write them out of this series, but yeah, Phoenix was the team that I thought, based on the fact that they're up 2-0 against Milwaukee last year, that's a chip, that's a burden, that's something in their mind that they've had to carry for the last year, and with Chris Paul, anything is possible, as we know. So I still think, you know, Phoenix is a team you got to knock off out west, but boy, things have really opened up, I think, out there as well. Now people now are thinking, oh, okay, we got an opportunity here. Plus, what happens if Luka comes back on? If they're down 2-1, what happens if Luka comes back Saturday in Game 4 against the Utah Jazz? Boy, things have suddenly really shifted now. That's what's going to be so exciting about these playoffs this year.
Yeah, I love the West. I actually just love the playoffs in general this season with how many teams there are that you look at and go, okay, they could win. Again, we're speaking to Kevin Calabro, play-by-play announcer, NBA on TNT, NBA on TV, and, of course, Portland Trailblazers voice, but forever, 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 former Seattle Supersonics play-by-play announcer. I grew up a huge Sonics fan. I'm sitting under posters that are framed of the glove and of Sean Kemp. I wonder what your feelings were with Marcus Smart winning the DPOY, because I'll tell you this, that I was a little torn, because one of the only things that you have as a Sonics fan is Gary Payton is the only point guard to win Defensive Player of the Year. And it was great how they did it, and Payton's involved, and he gives Marcus Smart the award, right. And he was absolutely deserving of this award. But it takes away this one little special thing about being a Sonics fan. I wonder how you felt about that moment.
Well, yeah, and I saw that. It was great. I thought Gary was terrific in presenting the award. You know, they surprised Marcus Smart. Congratulations to him. And yeah, for too long, it's been, I mean, since 95-96, it's been sort of the big man award. One exception, I guess, Ron Artest, who early in his career actually played a little bit of point two as well, but always considered a wing, you know, at 6'7" and a half, about 250 pounds. He was just a dynamic player. But so, you know, Marcus falls into that category. But yeah, it was kind of melancholy to see that another, you know, one of those old records go by the wayside. But I just remember what a terrific and fierce defender that Gary Payton was. It, you know, also was, you know, terrific on the offensive end, had a really unique and unusual type game. He was a point guard. He liked to post his opponents. He was 6'4". He was long and lean, and you could never really put a hit on the guy. And he'd get to the rim and wedge his way in there and do some magical things at the rim. And, of course, the three wasn't nearly as much of a factor at that time as it is in today's game, but Gary had a reasonably fine three-point shooter, was, you know, decent three-point shooter, but and a distributor of the basketball, but, you know, not a pure point guard, sort of a hybrid type guy that was just a both ends type player who could play 40 plus minutes a night, and if you didn't let him play 40 plus minutes, he didn't like you much. Yeah, it was good to see the glove making that presentation to Marcus Smart. You know, with all due respect, though, to the other guys, I mentioned Bridges. Rudy Gobert, I thought, had all the credentials this year to become, again, the Defensive Player of the Year. He's won it three of the last 4 years. But he had absolutely no help this year out on the perimeter defensively, and we saw in the playoffs. I mean, Rudy is their last stop defensively. And I just think the perimeter defense that the Jazz have played, particularly in the last couple of playoff games, has just been dreadful and has put it all on Rudy, unfortunately.
Yeah. They probably forced it a little bit Marcus's way because the Celtics were such a good team defensively, and so they give him the anchor. I also felt a little bit like, okay, he was a shooting guard up until this year. Then he did become a point guard, so now he does get the Gary Payton stealing of the stat thing. And yes, on Gary, I kind of hate a little bit, and I loved him as a trash talker throughout his career. It was great, but there's a little bit of me that gets annoyed that it's sort of become this thing where that's his legacy as a trash talker when he was such a great player like you just outlined. My only reservation about Gary Payton, the only thing that I hold against him a little bit, is because of that post game. You had a 5'10" Canadian kid who every time he tried to play basketball tried to post people up, and that didn't really work out. I probably should have worked on my other guard skills a little bit better. Like that was the only detraction from the Gary Payton experience. Kevin Calabro, it was great getting to talk to you today. Thanks so much for making time for our show.
A pleasure. Good luck tonight.
Thanks, Kevin. Play-by-play voice of the Sonics. I miss them. I want the Sonics back. Just, it's so true, though. It's I think that they forced it a little bit Smart's way. And I've been feeling a little sour about it, and I couldn't get that takeoff unless it was with Kevin Calabro, and I'm glad that we got to. Because he wasn't the Defensive Player of the Year. There's just no way about
it.
Like,
here's the thing about they forced it his way is it's 100 different people voting, and it's a blind vote. You don't see other people's ballots.
They forced it his way. They did the Kevin. Did you see what Kevin Durant said the other day about MVPs? Where he goes, you can't give MVP to Jokic because he's doing the same thing as he did last year. You got to give it to Embiid because he elevated his game more. I think that's what they did with Rudy Gobert, is that they go, we're bored of this, so let's give it to a different guy. The Celtics
and
are an awesome defensive team.
Yeah, yep. Gobert is also, he's won it three times, mm-hmm. and Utah's not been great in the playoffs every time, and Gobert's not a well-liked guy.
Exactly.
Like, that is a factor because there's no right answer to any of these awards. And, hey, the league did the MVP thing of, instead of best player on the best team, who's the best individual defender on the best defensive team? And actually, that's probably Robert Williams. But, you know,
Exactly. They forced it Marcus Smart's way. You just agreed.
It's also a reputation award, right?
Yes.
It's also a bit of a reputation award. No, I don't disagree that Marcus Smart was not on merit the depoy this year. I think there's a combination of reward the Celtics and it's a lifetime achievement award. I just don't think it was forced any kind of way because it's 100 people not communicating with each other to make the vote.
My issue here is that now Marcus Smart gets to be put into the same stratosphere as Gary Payton as a defensive guard, which is factually incorrect, and now I hate it. I hate it for the rest of the time. And Marcus Smart is actually one of my favorite players in the NBA. Like, honestly, I loved what he did this year. I love Marcus Smart. I'm a huge fan of Marcus Smart. And especially I was a fan of Marcus Smart when he would chuck horrible shots against the Raptors, you know, ill-timed three-pointers.
Bad Marcus Smart was the best Marcus Smart.
Exactly. And now he's really great Marcus Smart. But anyway, I've always liked him, even since college, even when he was getting into the trouble with the fan. Like, I've been a Marcus Smart backer, okay? Like, I just like the player. I like his I cannot tell you a thing that I do not like about the guy. But this now, you just spoiled one of my guys in the league because he stole my Gary Payton award. You stole my Gary Payton thing. And I could hear it in Kevin's voice, and that's why he's always a Sonic, as you could hear it in his voice. He had the same disappointment too. I'm feeling better this morning after that.